Well, I'll indulge in a little reminiscence for a few minutes first. I was Peter's fourth PhD student, I think. I went to Madison in 1977 and was assigned to Peter as an advisor because I put on my application for admission that I was interested in algebraic topology, even though I barely knew what the words meant at the time. And I never had a course from him, actually. I just kind of became his student by default. And it's turned out really well, actually. I sat through a course in 1982, a year-long course that Louis Solomon taught one semester and Peter taught the second semester. And it was not called Arrangements of Hyperplanes. It was called Reflection Groups. And I heard Louis mention Tarrau's name once in the fall semester, and then the next year Hero showed up, and I attended a seminar that Hero ran on free arrangements that had a speaker and three participants, Peter, Louis, and myself. So I was kind of a fly on the wall at the beginning of the subject, and 25 years later, I'm still having great fun studying the same things. It's kind of amazing that such a specialized topic can actually be so broad. I've had cause to learn a lot of really interesting mathematics in the process of trying to understand hyperplane arrangements. So it's not often that one has an opportunity to thank one's teachers in public, so I thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity. So thanks, Peter. It's been great. I brought a little something to read to you. This is an NSF review, a review of a 1989 NSF proposal that I wrote that actually got funded. And this is written by, I think I know who wrote it, and he's not here, a famous mathematician. I'm pretty sure he's not here. The first paragraph says, first a comment about the field. Complements of arrangements of hyperplanes seem to most topologists, when Ehrlich started working on them, to be a backwater, a very special class of spaces with no particular interest. Now it's clear that this is not true. They play a unifying role in mathematics. They are related in significant ways to combinatorics, to differential equations, and to K-theory, and lots of other stuff, as we've found out in the meantime. So anyway, I guess with that, I have lots more stories, but maybe I'll save them for later.
Were you funded?
I was. I knew somebody was going to ask me that. And it was approximately $16,000 for 2 years. So how many of you have written a grant proposal asking for $16,000 in the last 10 years or so? Anyway, amazingly enough, it was funded based on this guy's report, actually. I should thank him if he is in the audience. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about my current favorite topic, which is resonance varieties. I kind of had an epiphany a few weeks ago about how to generalize the theory of degree one resonance varieties partially to higher degree, and so I'm excited about it. So I'm gonna tell you about it, even though it's kind of fresh and still kind of half baked a little bit. So to start with, I want to tell you, especially those of you who aren't familiar, a little bit of the story of degree one resonance varieties. Okay, so a little notation. I guess I'll start here. Maybe I'll do this so I don't forget. So let's start with an arrangement of hyperplanes in CL. And, or I guess I wrote in here. Sometimes we think of it as an arrangement in projective space. It's about the same. And A, let's call this soft chalk. This is the OS algebra. And generators E sub I, which correspond to these logarithmic forms. D alpha I over alpha I, where the ith hyperplane is the kernel homogeneous linear form, so this is a central arrangement. Okay, and then you can actually immediately define the first resonance variety of A. Or I should say, for now, I'll just do this over an arbitrary field K. So then the first resonance variety is the set of all lambdas in A1 such that there exists an eta also in A1, not a multiple of lambda, with lambda times eta equals zero. Okay? And so and so a little more notation, I'll write lambda in terms of the basis this way and eta this way. And we'll say if lambda and eta have this property, we'll call the pair a resonant pair. Okay? And then one more thing. If X is a subset of A, then write, for example, lambda sub X would be the sum of the lambda I's where HI is in X. Okay? And same for eta. And then maybe I need more room to write this theorem. So here's kind of the first. So it's a very simple definition, and actually it's not too hard to characterize these lambdas, and then, as some of you know, the simple characterization leads to lots and lots of really interesting structure. But here's the simple version in the form that I'm going to try to generalize, I guess. It says lambda eta is a resonant pair if and only if for every rank 2 flat x. So I just think of, so rank 2 flat means the codimension 2 element of the intersection lattice, but I think of it as being a collection of hyperplanes, all the hyperplanes containing that subspace. What has to happen? The determinant of lambda sub I and lambda sub x and eta sub I and eta sub x must be zero. Okay? I think that's the simplest statement. So this is kind of a lemma, actually. So what does this say? So take X and write it out, HI1 up to HIK. Okay? And then there's kind of two ways that this can happen. One is that these two sums can both be zero, in which case the rank of this matrix is 1. And then in the other case, at least one of them is non-zero. Okay? So by the way, interrupt me if you ever have any questions or comments. This is for all A? For all? Yeah, this should say for all I in X. H I in X. That's better. Thank you. It was late last night. here's the observation. If this pair of sums is not 0, 0, then we need more space. Well, then look at this matrix. You take lambda I1, eta I1, lambda ik, eta ik, and then lambda x, eta x. And this condition up here, since this column is not zero, basically says all of the other columns are parallel to it, in a sense. And so this has rank 1. And so then it's still true if you cover up the last column, this matrix has rank 1. Okay, so that means that the pair, so I have to make this assumption. So let's assume that each lambda I, eta I, is different from 0, 0, which you can always arrange for by deleting some of the hyperplanes if both components are 0. Then this pair, lambda eta, determines a partition of A. By saying two hyperplanes are in the same block of the partition when the two columns, when this 2x2 matrix has determinant 0. I think I wrote that down. Oh, yeah. So HI twiddles HJ if and only if lambda I and J eta I eta J equals 0. And so you get a partition of A, and it turns out this partition, it has one property. It has a couple of properties, but one of them is, if, in this case, where lambda x, eta x is not 0, 0, that implies that x is contained in some block of pi. So that's the name of the partition. Okay? And then, I don't want to discuss it, but pi is what's called it has a second property that is called neighborliness, neighborly partitions. And it turns out that this partition, let's see what I have written here. Well, so all of this is for an arbitrary field. In fact, actually, I write down this little corollary. The corollary is that R1 of A is ruled by planes because once we have a resonant pair, because we're in an quotient of an exterior algebra, if lambda times eta is 0, then any linear combination of lambda and eta times eta is 0, and so the whole plane is contained in R1. So all of that is true in general. And then if k is equal to c, this partition pi, with a lot of additional work, some of it due to Lidgober and Yuzvinsky, and some of it due to myself and Yuzvinsky, and actually part of it was done independently by Miguel Marco. Pi gives rise to what's called a multinet, structure on A. And from that, let's just say a special. Oh, I guess I should now restrict. And if we're talking about line arrangements, L equals 3, a special pencil of curves in P2 that I think maybe that without going into details, the best description of it is that it somehow interpolates somehow the lines of A. So I actually don't really want to talk about that a whole lot, except I might use it here in a minute. So, what time is it? What time did I start? I have a half hour. Okay. That's good. I'm debating, you know, I have section 2 now, which if anything's going to go, it's going to be section 2, unfortunately. So, I don't know if I should do it or not. This, I'll give it a shot. So this is all kind of coming out of a joint project that has been ongoing for at least 4 years with Dan Cohen and Graham Denham and Alexander Varchenko about critical points of master functions. And so I can give you a little bit of an idea about that just briefly now, I think. So let me do that. Critical. Just so maybe this is some motivation of master functions. So, let's see here. Oh, so look at this lambda. It's summation lambda I EI, and under this identification of EI with these logarithmic differentials, this corresponds to summation lambda I d alpha I over alpha I, and this is itself a logarithmic derivative. It's d log of the product of the alpha I's to the lambda I power. Okay, so this thing we'll call phi sub lambda. It should be a familiar-looking object, I guess, to a lot of people. This is called an A master function. You know, you probably know the usual story. If lambda is not integral, then it's a multivalued function. And it has some connection with hypergeometric functions. And so let's see. So, and we're interested in the critical points of this function, and there's some connection between lambda being a resonant weight and whether the critical points of this function are isolated or not. And I can kind of demonstrate that in at least for these line arrangements kind of quickly. So by this theorem of myself and Sergei's, there are, let's say, special, there is a special resonant pair that I think I called sigma tau, such that, so this is all under the assumption that lambda itself is a resonant weight, and so lambda eta is a resonant pair. There's a special resonant pair such that two things happen. Lambda is a linear combination of sigma and eta. So how did I write this? Changing notation. So what should I call this? I guess I can call it A1 sigma plus A2 tau. Beta is B1 sigma plus B2 tau, where all these coefficients are just scalars. And the kicker is that the two master functions corresponding to sigma and tau satisfy a linear relation like this. And so I'll give you a quick example of this, just so you have something to hold on to. If this is the, this is our favorite arrangement, it's actually the D3 arrangement. This is the origin. And just what this relation looks like in this case is x squared plus y squared over x squared minus z squared plus y squared minus z squared over x squared minus z squared. If you do the algebra, you'll find that that's equal to 1. And each of those is a master function. You see that the numerator and denominator each factors into a product of linear forms, and they're defining linear forms for this arrangement to choose the coordinates right. So as I said, we're interested in critical points of phi lambda. I should move over here. And maybe so this master function phi lambda is it's a monomial combination of phi sigma and phi tau because of the logarithmic business. If you just look at the definitions, it's phi sigma to the A1 times phi tau to the A2. Okay? Okay, so consider the following. There's a little factorization. I can map C2 to C2 using phi sigma phi tau, and then I can map C2 to C by what I'll call mu sub A of y1, y2 is just y1 to the a1, y2 to the a2. And under this first map, because of this linear relation, the image lies in this line, which maybe I'll call sigma. And then you have this map mu sub A. So forgetting about this first map, let's call this phi. With a little bit of calculus, you realize that the critical points of this composite function are just pre-images of critical points of mu A restricted to this line. So I guess I'll write it down this way. Mu sub A. And it's pretty easy to see that mu sub A restricted to sigma has a unique isolated, well, critical point. You know, for generic, I'll put it in quotes maybe, A1, A2, namely, they should both be non-zero. I think that's all that's required. And so it's just, as I say, it's Lagrange multipliers problem. You know, you have this one critical point where, I mean, this is the picture I think of anyway, where the mu a equals constant curve is tangent to sigma. And then the critical locus of P sub A call this point P. I'll buy Fields a new box of chalk. Then the critical locus of P sub lambda is just the inverse image of P, which is a curve in C2, and by this work with Sergey, it's irreducible. So I think I drew a picture of that too. I got lots of color. So here's the arrangement, like in this example. And then the critical locus is going to look something like this, perhaps. Okay? So this this idea generalizes a little bit further, and that's really what I want to talk about. That whole thing was just a little digression. So where am I now? Page 3. So now I'll get to the main topic of the talk, higher order products. So this is what I want to generalize, is this story about resonant pairs. So let's see. So this is section 3. So here's what I want to do. I want to assume that I have lambda 1 through lambda p linearly independent elements of A1 with product lambda 1 through lambda p equals 0. So for the experts, you know, this is related to the degree p resonance variety, which you would say, I think maybe I even wrote this down somewhere. I'll write it down here. If we actually knew that lambda 2, that the product of lambda 2 through lambda p was not in the ideal generated by lambda 1, then this would imply that lambda 1 is in the pth resonance variety of A. And at least in the special case I'm going to talk about, we do know this. And so this is some information about the degree p resonance variety. I think what we call this is monomial resonance, because this lambda 2 through lambda p is a cocycle for lambda 1, but it's decomposable. And so this is a special kind of degree p resonance. So I guess the observation is this. Under this assumption, this says that d phi lambda 1 over phi lambda 1, that's just what, that's what this element corresponds to, wedge up to d phi lambda p over phi lambda p is equal to 0, So this is an equivalence, and this is equivalent to, there exists a polynomial relation among the phis. Equals zero. Like in the previous example, phi sigma 1 plus phi sigma 2, or phi sigma plus phi tau minus 1 equals 0, and you can use that to write down relations among any resonant pairs, you know, any master functions for any two resonant pairs. So then the point is that the existence of P can be detected using tropical geometry, tropical stuff, and nested sets. So I'll tell you briefly about nested sets, and maybe I can sketch the tropical geometry argument, because I think that would be of interest to at least one person in the audience, I think, if she's here. So, let's see, how does this work? Page 4, oh right, I've got to define. So, this is, I think, the standard notation. Take G to be the set of all irreducible flats. So subsets of A such that X is an irreducible flat. This is called the minimal building set. And then a nested set, I guess I'll call it N. It's a subset of G such that, so this is a definition. It's a subset of G that satisfies for any pairwise incomparable subset, x1 through xk of n, the join, so this is, I guess, now in the lattice of flats or something, the join is not an element of G. So I'll give you an example of that. Take this arrangement we had before, like this, and let me number the hyperplanes now, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then here's an irreducible flat. Well, first of all, G consists of the 6 hyperplanes together with these 4 flats of size 3 or bigger, so this one is 1, 3, 6. What are the others? 2, 3, 5. And 2, 4, 6. And 1, 4, 5. And some nested sets. Here's a couple of nested sets. There's kind of two types. One is a pair of hyperplanes that intersect in a double point will satisfy this property. And another type is, take one of the irreducible flats, like 1, 3, 6, just take an ordered subset, basically, of G that also satisfies this property. So And I'll show you one more example. So this is a matroid picture. This is how I like to think about arrangements of rank four. This is just the dots represent the hyperplanes. So I'll number them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In this case, the building set is, again, the hyperplanes themselves, 1 through 6, and then there's 3 irreducible flats of rank 3. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 5, 6, and 3, 4, 5, 6. And some nested sets are, for example, 1, 4, 5. You see, 1, 4, 5 corresponds to this diagonal plane that only has 3 points on it. So the join, 1, 3, and 5, join together to a reducible flat because it only has 3 points on it. It's Boolean. And then there's other examples like this, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay? And then there's a lot of other nested sets in that example. So now, at least I can state the theorem. Looks like this. And this, the proof, I think, requires K equals C, or at least characteristic zero coefficients, but I suspect maybe the theorem is true in general, I'm not sure. Anyway, it says this, if you have lambda 1 through lambda P, subset of A1, linearly independent, then the product lambda 1 through lambda p is equal to 0 if and only if the rank, now this is the analog of that kind of lemma, the low-level theorem that I wrote down for the p equals 2 case. How did I write this? if and only if, for every nested set, X1 through XR, the rank of this matrix is, so I'm going to write down a matrix that has P rows, and the rank should be less than P. And so remember my notation, lambda 1 is a vector. I'm going to say its components are lambda 1, 1, lambda 1, 2, and so on. What you do is you take lambda 1, and then comma x1, that'll mean the sum of the entries corresponding to the hyperplanes in x1, and then lambda 2, lambda 1, x2, and so on up to lambda 1, xr, and then there's one of those rows for each of the lambdas. That rank should be less than or equal to P for every nested set. And because time is pretty short, I'll leave it as an exercise to compare this with the previous lemma for P equals 2 and think about what the nested sets look like for arrangements of rank 3. And you'll see that this specializes to the previous statement. Okay? Yes. Okay. So let me, just for the benefit of the few, I'll just draw a little diagram and talk through the proof because it's kind of interesting, and then I'll talk about some consequences. So this actually isn't what I discovered 3 weeks ago. This I knew last summer. It's just that 3 weeks ago I figured out how to use this to get something useful. So let's see, what's the proof? You remember we're trying to detect whether there's a polynomial relation among the master functions. So we do the same thing that we did before, map CL to CP by, we're looking at this map, CL to CP, that's given by the P master functions. And remember, each of these master functions is a monomial combination of the defining linear forms of the arrangement. So factor this through this, this is our favorite, one of our favorite linear functions, the function that maps CL into CN by the defining forms, okay? And then follow that with this monomial map that's actually determined by the weights. So lambda, I'm thinking of as this matrix. Lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda p. Matrix whose rows are the coefficients of those one forms. So then what you do is, I'll write the name down, the names. There's a paper of Alicia Dickenstein, Eva Feichner, and Baron Sternfels about tropical discriminants. It says we tropicalize everything in sight, and the tropicalizations satisfy the same factorization. Now, why would I tropicalize? It's because the question is whether the image over here is P minus one dimensional or whether it's P dimensional. It's a subvariety of CP. Its tropicalization has the same dimension. So if you can tell whether the tropicalization has dimension less than P, then that would tell you that this polynomial P exists. Okay? So what's the tropicalization? According to Dickenstein, Feichner, and Sternfels, it's the image of the composite of these two maps. Okay? So now I'm not going to write anything else down. The image of this map is the Bergman fan of the arrangement. The tropicalization of this map is just the linear map given by this matrix. Okay, that's step one. And step two is this theorem of Feichner and Yuzvinsky that says the nested set fan subdivides the Bergman complex. And I'm only interested in dimensions. So that means that if I take a cone of the nested set fan, it's contained in a cone of the Bergman complex. If I look at the image of that cone and detect what its dimension is, if I look at the maximum, that'll tell me the dimension of the image of the Bergman complex. And so that's where this condition comes from. The nested set fan, I should say, is the cones are generated by vectors of zeros and ones that have ones on the elements of the nested set and zeros elsewhere. And so that's how you end up getting sums of lambdas in this matrix. So this condition just guarantees that the image of every cone in the nested set fan has dimension less than P. Okay? So my time's up. So what I'm going to do is, I said I actually figured out how to use this recently, so I'll just give an advertisement for the next talk, which maybe is going to be in Japan next year, I don't know. So if you, and this is maybe more for the experts, if you now assume that the arrangement is P minus 1 generic, which means that it's generic up through rank P minus 1. So a rank 3 arrangement is 1 generic, okay? So you assume it's P minus 1 generic, and then you have some control over what the nested sets look like. That's why I did this example. This arrangement is too generic, because there's no three-point lines. And then you can actually kind of play the same game that I did on that board over there for P equals 2, and you find that for each nested set, you have two cases where these sums are all zero, or some one of them is not zero, and you can kind of play the whole same game. There's a completely analogous thing that happens, except, so this is really for the experts, what I realized 3 weeks ago is that this neighborly partition that I talked about, it doesn't generalize to a partition for these higher rank things. What it generalizes to is a matroid. And so, well, I didn't write the partition down. I guess for this example, the matroid that I used to think was a partition is a matroid of rank 2 that has multiple points. And the multiple points are the blocks of the partition. And so the analog of a neighborly partition in higher dimensions is really a matroid with multiple points. And the analog of the blocks of the partition are the flats of rank p minus 1. And there's the same two conditions on those blocks. And so I have a whole new game to play with arrangements again for the next year, because a lot of this stuff about pencils and the matrix Q that Anatoly and Sergey did, I think a lot of it may push through to this higher dimensional special case. And so, you know, stay tuned. Come back next year. So thanks for your attention. Well, that's what I'm saying. There might be.
Mass to what? Instead of curves, mass to what?
I haven't even gotten that far with it. You know, I was just thinking. There's, you know, there's an incidence matrix. The analog of the matrix J that comes up, and if you take J transpose J minus E, you get a generalized Cartan matrix. I don't know how much of the rest of the analysis goes through, because I just haven't had time to think about it yet. But and so I don't know what it would be a pencil of, but maybe Igor knows, actually. If you're getting isolated non-normal crossing varieties as singular elements of pencils, maybe the P1, which is with surfaces as fibers.